Your Honor, the second case on the docket this morning is 2-25-0213, Deion Snyder, plaintiff appellant, the Durham Police Pension Board, defendant and appellee. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Brian G. Smith. Arguing on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Laura J. Goodwin.
Mr. Smith, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. I represent Brian Smith. I represent Mr. Snyder in this matter before Your Honors. The real issue before the Court this morning is whether or not the Pension Board's decision is against the manifest weight of the evidence, finding that my client was not disabled from service as a police officer. Understanding the high bar that manifest weight of the evidence certainly puts on us, I think what is evident from both the Board's decision and looking at the medical records is that the Board's decision relies upon only the evidence that it felt and I think admitted to in its argument that bolstered its decision. It used that word bolstered, indicating, I think, from the language of that decision that it was selectively choosing evidence that wanted. Now, in a vacuum, I suppose, saying we believe this evidence is more persuasive would be one way to argue it, but to dismiss, as it did, the functional capacity exam of Dr. Glynn, and to essentially dismiss the third IME, Dr. Bergen, in the manner that it did, shows that it was acting in an arbitrary manner.
We don't reweigh the evidence at this level, correct?
Correct.
So the findings and conclusions of the administrative agency on questions of fact.
Yeah,
the prima facie, true and correct, correct?
Correct.
So we get past that.
Yes, sure. And what I think, what is evident here is looking at the manner in which those were applied, though, is to say, look, we have two IMEs that found in favor of, or found him to be not disabled, one that found that it was. Now, I think, as I noted in my briefs, that even the two IMEs that agree with, that my client was not disabled, don't seem to agree on the presence of a fracture, which I think is notable, and also, for example, Dr. Graff is sort of equivocal in saying, I can't substantiate why this would be disabling. Not that, like, there's no fracture here, he's fine, he is not disabled. Maybe that's the ultimate, what he says in the end of his, in the questions he's asked by the board. But I think, again, given the evidence that we see here, you know, he's saying there's still a fracture here, and notably, both Graff and Mohan, despite finding him not disabled, don't say he's not in pain. This is malingering. This is someone who is not clearly not injured, or I guess in pain. Again, I get to, maybe that's a distinction with or without a difference here, that everyone seems to agree that he's suffering some form of pain, because we look at the medical records that go all the way up to about a week, week and a half before he retires, saying he's still undergoing treatment. He's these medial branch blocks, facet injections, discussion of kyphoplasty, which my understanding is that is essentially injecting cement into his spine. So even if we take the two IMEs that say, well, he's not disabled, this is to say, if you agree he's experiencing pain and he's still undergoing all of these forms of treatment, sort of where does that leave us?
And the question would be, is the pain, does the pain preclude him from doing his job? I guess is what the question that they talked about. You mentioned Dr. Glynn's findings. Mm-hmm. Didn't the court basically dismiss his findings, saying they weren't credible or something to that effect? They basically dismissed his findings.
Yes, Justice Shostak. They said they give him no weight. And it wasn't even we don't find this persuasive because, you know, well, the IMEs that all reviewed his report said, okay, this, we disagree with the way the functional capacity exam was conducted, or one of our findings about his ability, I think it was the strength in his lower legs, doesn't match with our findings. I think something along those lines is a fairly subjective thing of, much like any of these things with a low back injury, you know, something we don't have a blood test or a, you know, for a respiratory test for a firefighter, for example, where we could say, it's either yes or no, it's black and white. Obviously, these sorts of injuries are always somewhat reliant on subjective evidence. And again, I think going to all of these treatments that were going on subsequent to his being released to work, as the board heavily relies on Dr. Sitow's release to work, which was, I believe he saw him February 10th. And in order, Dr. Sitow saw him once.
You're essentially, you are asking us to take a look at the evidence and see whether or not there's sufficient evidence in the record to support the board's conclusion.
Yes, Your Honor. Justice Burkett.
You cite Kouzoukas in your reply brief, but that case is distinguishable, correct? I mean, if you look at that case, the doctors in that case, all of the doctors said they observed objective evidence of muscle spasms. Mm-hmm. In this case, unlike Kouzoukas, the doctors disagreed with each other. In Kouzoukas, all of the doctors were unanimous that plaintiff was disabled. Mm-hmm. That's not the case here, right?
Correct, Justice Burkett. I think there where I draw the distinction would be that, well, for example, I think in Kouzoukas they were saying, look, there were some back spasms and other things just in, again, these sort of standard...
And there was objective evidence of it.
And there was. And I think here what's notable is that despite Dr. Graff and Mohan finding him not disabled ultimately and saying some of these issues weren't present, they're not saying, you know, there's nothing in the record anywhere, frankly, that says... they don't believe him. There doesn't seem to be, like, whether it's explicit or even implicit, really, that Mr. Snyder's, whether it's his testimony or what he was telling the doctors at the time, which I suppose would be more relevant at that point, is he's not faking this. This isn't, you know, are we seeing the same level of disability or physical outward symptoms that are measurable as is in Kouzoukas? Perhaps not, because as Justice Burkett, as you note, I think in Kouzoukas, the doctor said there was the paraspinal spasms and things of that nature that are present in some of these evaluations and not others, but we don't have the doctors ultimately saying, you know, are you just faking this? Like, I don't believe you.
Right. This well, at one point, Mr. Snyder told Dudzinski that he's definitely improving and very eager to return to work. Mm-hmm. When was that?
I believe that was in... Because he was returned to work in, it was either, I believe, either late February or early March.
So it was early on.
It was earlier on, certainly before we get to what it appears from the record is that we have a fairly compressed time period here. He was injured January 3rd, and he retires July 9th, I believe the date is, but mid-July. There was some improvement, but I think that's consistent with what we see in the medical treatment records and what I think we know from other cases of this nature and just, I suppose, to some extent, common sense would tell us. Something like a muscle strain that isn't necessarily a linear improvement.
Well, he testified that he rides a recumbent bicycle for exercise, he jogs with his son, and he's a handyman around the house.
He did, and I draw that, and I think I addressed that in my briefs, probably both the appellate brief and the reply brief, is ultimately here, it's not whether or not he... is laid up in bed and is in traction, can he do the job of a police officer?
It's uncomfortable for him to sit 8 hours a day.
And the village requires him to sit in a patrol car. He was a patrol officer, he's a field training officer. I suppose, whether he's a field training officer or not, if he's on patrol, we know that means he's sitting in a car, and he testified to that he sits in a car for essentially an entire shift. Maybe not every time he's on duty, but many days that's what patrol officers are required to do. Not only sit in a patrol car, and as he said, that's one of the biggest issues that he had was for sitting for long periods of time, A, that caused pain just in and of itself, but also the then requirement to get up quickly, and if you've got to arrest someone, chase someone down, even just getting out of the car to issue a speeding ticket to a motorist requires you to get up and move smoothly into a car, and if you're hurt, whether it's a tingling pain, you're bent over because your back seizes up, that puts the officer at risk. And I think
all these arguments were made before the board, correct?
They were.
And in you suggest that we should carefully consider Dr. Brogan's opinion because his answers were, quote, most directly and, emphasis added, most credibly. Mm-hmm. So you're asking us to compare that testimony and say that his testimony is more credible.
Well, I suppose, so perhaps my use of credible wasn't meant to be in the legal term of it, but saying more applicable to what a patrol officer in Mr. Snyder's case is asked to do. I think that's why I know we discuss, or the response discusses Well, it's in the, you know, the questions we give to the IMEs to discuss with the officer his duties and what he does and all that. But Dr. Bergen, the one who notably finds my client not to be, or I'm sorry, to be disabled, actually addresses it in his answers and says, look, he would lose control of his gun if he has to grapple with someone. And notably, it's both from that IME and in Snyder's testimony and throughout the medical records of different doctors, the issue of the duty belt. He has to wear the duty belt to do his job as a patrol officer.
And that was the issue in Kazukas, right? That she could not wear the belt.
Right. And it's even replayed, I think, both in his testimony and it's mentioned to one of the doctors, and I apologize, I don't know remember which one offhand, that he attempted to build his tolerance, going, I would characterize that as above and beyond. If I wear this almost like progressive overload with like lifting weights of, if I wear it for a little longer every day, maybe I'll get over this. Maybe I'll be able to wear the belt for periods of time. And he's talking about adjusting it and wearing it a different way. You certainly can't say that my client didn't do everything he could to try to get beyond this. I think in that very specific instance to say, the wearing the duty belt is clearly required. I mean, you look at the job description. I don't know if the job description itself specifically mentions the duty belt, but I think it's accepted that an officer has to wear a duty belt to be armed to conduct his job as an officer, unless he's working in, you know, an administrative role in the department only. And that's clear throughout the medical records that is one of the biggest problems, is that he putting that duty belt on, the pull on, I assume it's, you know, with the lower back and aggravating the pain in the core is what creates that issue. So I think that's that, and then looking at Dr. Glynn's testing of his ability, not just simply in the other IMEs to, okay, can you squat and stand up? Can you walk on your toes? Can you walk on your heels? That's notable in that I think it's Dr. Dedinsky had him do the exact same test in January. I believe it was January 27th. It was word for word almost. Can you walk on your heels? Can you walk on your toes? Can you squat and rise?
Did Bergen have him address other police job duties more so than the other IMEs?
He did, because in his answer he discusses specifically, again, they don't put word for word, there's not a transcript, of course, of what they talked about, but that Dr. Bergen, in his answers to the ultimate questions posed to him by the board, said, directly addressing his ability to protect his weapon, to arrest someone. The other doctors, the IMEs, Mohan and Graff, never did that. And I think, again, Dr. Glynn, I understand he's not one of the three IMEs here, but that testing of saying, okay, you can squat and stand up in a matter of 2-3 seconds. Putting him through that, and I think it's Dr. Graff saying it was 20 minutes I was with him. Dr. Glynn spent 2 hours with him. Now, you can argue with some of what he testified to, perhaps, or some things, but to say spending that amount of time with him and putting through things that would fatigue him.
Was there any evidence that Officer Snyder tried air cushion or anything of that nature to try to ease the pain? I know that, you know, a lot of truck drivers, a lot of people who get injured will use an air cushion. Was there any evidence that he tried to accommodate or tried to reduce the pain?
I'm not recollecting specifically an air cushion in his thing. I think it was more about the duty belt pull. The air cushion, I understand you'd sit on it and perhaps it would change angle in which you're sitting.
It's going to protect that portion of his backside where the injury is.
Right. Well, and if it's the L2, sort of in the low back, he did, and there was a point there which he was wearing a brace, something else to sort of stabilize the area, would that have the same effect or help in the same way an air cushion would? I couldn't say. I don't think air cushion, specifically Justice Burkett, is in anywhere in the record. But I think the duty belt thing is probably the biggest thing we could point to and say he tried to do something to adjust wearing it a slightly different way, building up his tolerance at home, when certainly not required to do that.
What's the weight of the duty belt?
I believe it's 15 to 20 pounds fully loaded. I believe that's in the record, but I don't want to say for absolute certain that that's...
I think you're right.
But I believe that's approximately what a standard duty belt would weigh, you know, if there's other things. But again, I think that, and then looking at Dr. Glynn's review of him saying, when you put him through fatiguing testing, that shows more relative to what he would do during his job. That is something, and I think given that testing, given what Dr. Bergen testified to, put in his opinion, that evidence is the most credible evidence we have. Now, again, I understand what the burden is here in saying that, you know, looking at this, but saying when the board selected to say we're going to only essentially consider the evidence to give it any weight.
Your reply brief suggests that their treatment of the Dr. Glynn was an abuse of discretion. You cite Horton Casso for that. That case was about a municipality wanting to intervene on, I think, a duty pension issue. And the appellate court found that was an abuse of discretion not to allow it. But how is Horton Casso like this?
Certainly, Justice Mullen, the facts there of that specific issue, that is not what's at issue here, but if I could finish my answer. The issue in Horton Casso and the line from there is about ignoring a critical issue. And I think that's what I'm saying. Dr. Glynn tested the weight of what was put on him and more accurately testing it. And to just say, we don't agree with his ultimate conclusions, but we're just not going to consider what he wrote is where I was taking that from to say that's an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
You have an opportunity for rebuttal, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Laura Goodlow. I represent the appellees in this matter. As you're aware, this is an administrative review. Not to re-educate the court, but I think it's very important to point out that it is purely within the province of the pension board trustees to accord weight to the evidence and testimony before it. And the proper standard of review is the manifest weight standard of review. And then so long as there's competent evidence in the record to support the board's decision, it should be affirmed. And only
Ms. Goodlow, sure. How about if the board didn't take certain things into consideration, i.e. the fatigue testing by Dr. Glynn, and there was no fatigue testing by anyone else? Or Dr. Glynn, the only one testing him regarding the weight of the duty belt? I mean, how would that, at that point, can we say, they didn't take into consideration this information. Can we then take it into consideration in our ruling?
I believe that the board did take it into consideration. It ultimately did not accord weight to it. I think that's the difference here. Mm-hmm. The board reviewed the report. The board took that report, gave it to the IME providers for their supplemental opinion to ensure that we had a full and complete record. The board listened to chiropractor Glenn's testimony and ultimately did not want to accord weight to his opinion for numerous reasons. We see the three IME providers who reviewed this report have a bunch of commentary and response. Dr. Graff noted that the findings were flawed, that it was not a valid FCE. He also noted that they were utilizing an AMA impairment rating, which is contraindicated for purposes of making determinations as to disability. He also noted that during his evaluation with respect to strength, he was a 5 out of 5, whereas Glynn reported that he was a 3 out of 5, which means he could not stand against gravity, which makes no sense given the fact that this is an active person.
But is there a difference between him being a 5 out of 5 on strength, and you know that may be him lifting his leg and putting weight on it, versus wrestling a defendant to the ground?
There's certainly a difference, and we do see functional capacity evaluations in disability adjudications. However, we also have three orthopedic surgeons who a part of their practice is providing independent medical evaluations that take into account the job description, the duties and obligations of police officers, and they perform medical evaluations that they deem to be satisfactory in providing an empirical response or a conclusion as to whether or not somebody can perform unrestricted police duty. And I would presume that these doctors who have performed IMEs over and over again know exactly what they're looking at when they're looking at not only the diagnostics and they're doing the physical examination. So I feel as though these IME providers, and particularly Dr. Mohan and Dr. Graff, did their job here, and we can rely upon that and not rely upon an invalid FCE that these three IME providers have never seen a chiropractor perform in their experience.
Well, they relied on Sitow, his statement. But his statement was in February 22, and he had only seen Mr. Snyder one time. There was a lot of treatment after that, and there were more opinions. How do they give weight to Sitow?
I think they gave weight to Sitow because of the fact that this gentleman was injured in January of 2022, stopped treatment at the end of May of 2022. So we have a very small window of opportunity to review medical records in support of the condition that he was being treated by. We have Dr. Sitow and Dr. Dudinsky both putting in their medical treatment notes that they feel he could return to full and unrestricted duty. These two doctors saw the appellant closer in duration of time to the actual injury, and they thought that he was doing well. And he actually self-reported to these providers, too, that he felt like he was almost 90% better, that he wanted to go back to work. And so I don't think it was outside of the realm of possibility for the pension board to accord weight to those opinions because they coincide or conform with the ultimate conclusions of Dr. Mohan and Dr. Graff. I would like to just go on and make a couple additional points.
Yes.
Dr. Mohan and Dr. Graff are board-certified orthopedic surgeons. Both unequivocally rendered this individual not disabled from service. Just because they didn't go on to talk about what restrictions the appellant would have, it doesn't make any sense, because if they're concluding that he's not disabled, they're not going to talk about a duty belt. They felt that he was...
Well, I mean, there's something being disabled, then there's something being disabled in doing his job. Right?
Correct.
So, I mean, that's what we're here about. That's what he was there about. So why wouldn't they talk about his disability in performing his job duties?
I believe they did. If you would look at the cover letters I sent to all three providers, I asked each and every provider to discuss with the appellant his perceived limitations, discuss with the appellant his job duties and what's causing him to have filed for disability. I feel like all those providers took that into consideration. I also feel as though both providers provided a very detailed medical analysis. They provided a very detailed medical recitation that the applicant at the time confirmed was accurate. And so I feel like these doctors did their job. And ultimately, we have a split case here where we have Dr. Mohan, we have Dr. Graff, we have Dr. Bergen. There's no way that my board could accord weight to Dr. Mohan and Dr. Graff and then accord the same weight to Dr. Bergen because there's a difference in opinion. And again, it's purely within their province to rectify those issues in the record, and they ultimately found that the totality of the evidence with the four corners of what we had in terms of testimony evidence supported that finding that he's not disabled. I also believe that the timeline bolsters the fact that the disability determination was not against the manifest weight. This gentleman was injured in January. He sought medical treatment until the end of May. At the end of May, he had a second MRI that showed that he was improving, so some additional diagnostic testing that shows he's getting better. He then unilaterally decided to file for disability and also file for a retirement pension. However, he didn't have the age yet to go into pay status. And so I think he made the decision that he was going to be done with police service, and that's perfectly acceptable.
He testified that he was a handyman around the house, that his wife had switched positions, so he was trying to do quote-unquote construction stuff around the house. And the rest of that, most of the time, the most I can do is jogging with my son. I think it's called a recumbent bike, where I have it at home, so I try to get some exercise. He said he enjoyed being a stay-at-home dad for his two kids.
And I think that coincides with the board's ultimate conclusion. I clearly understand that those activities are not the same duties as a police officer.
But they are activities.
They are activities. I mean, I can't jog very far, I could tell you that much. But I know that those activities, to me and to the pension board, coincide more so with Dr. Mohan and Dr. Graff's opinions. And I didn't mean in my decision order to use the language that he's claiming sounds as if the board was just cherry-picking information. We weren't. We're looking at the entire record, and I feel like everything in the entire record points to the conclusion that the board reached.
And he's trying to, and he's looking for business opportunities. He wants to start his own business.
Correct. That as well. And I'd like to point out, too, that, you know, in trying to persuade you that Dr. Mohan and Dr. Graff's opinions are incorrect, he's citing to a number of cases that just are totally an opposite. One case is the Wade case. My late father was on that case. He lost. I had to hear about that case for years and years and years. I know that in Wade, Dr. Milgram had a ton of flaws in terms of his report. misstatements of facts, not looking at CERN medical records. Same with Hampton. This didn't occur here. The appellant himself certified that the medical recitations provided were accurate. There's no glaring discrepancies like in Hampton or like in Wade that would dissuade this court towards upholding and affirming the decision. And finally, I'd like to just point out that in the recent Moreland case, I believe that that supports the board's decision as well. In that state Supreme Court case, we had an individual who had multiple treatment records, had diagnostic imagery confirming that he had a lumbar disc problem. We had work comp IME providers who certified that there was an issue. And then we had the pension board's sole IME provider, Dr. Levin, who said that this individual is not disabled. The board gave proper analysis to Dr. Levin's opinion, and ultimately the state Supreme Court affirmed it for the basis that we're standing here today, that so long as there's competent evidence in the record to support the board's decision, it should be affirmed. What I think is happening here today is that counsel for the appellant is asking you to reweigh the evidence. It's actually kind of accusing me of doing what it kind of is doing in terms of cherry-picking bits and pieces of information, putting it together like Humpty Dumpty, and then overturning the board's decision. And that really is not the court's process here. And so for the reasons I've stated, I respectfully request that the board's decision be affirmed. I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Thank you again. In response to Ms. Goodloe's argument there, I think what draws our attention to the why the decision against the manifest weight of the evidence is the reliance, to move beyond the IMEs for a moment, is Dr. Sitow and Dr. Dudinsky. It relies on Dr. Sitow and Dudinsky in its ruling saying they returned him to work. Dr. Sitow, as we discussed moments ago, only saw him once, February 10th. That is several months prior to the ultimate day of retirement, and as the Justice had noted, there was quite a lot of medical treatment between now and then. So to say he went back to work in one instance, was returned to work or full duty, I don't know that that really bolsters the opinion in the way that that would be to say that this is somehow bolstering in conformance with what the IMEs have found. And then Dr. Dudinsky returned him to work in February and then I believe April 1st. But again, the record notes that Dr. Dudinsky on June 30th noted that Mr. Snyder's back pain was, quote, debilitating, and that he couldn't do the job duties. So again, I think trying to say we're relying on these opinions or these orders from the doctors to say you can go back to work when the situation, clearly the medical records had changed, again, goes to, is that against the manifest weight of the evidence to say this is what we're basing this on when these doctors, ignoring when they made those decisions that they or those orders and those opinions that they said, well, in February you can go back to work. April 1st you can go back to work. But in June 30th you're having debilitating back pain. And again, he's seeing Dr. Marsigli and other places for all these other treatments. Clearly, again, if this was just made up out of whole cloth, would these other doctors have been treating him for these things and actually giving him injections and doing these things that addresses that pain? So I think that goes to the board using those two treating physicians as wait for their opinions is, well, but again, it's totally out of context for when this decision was made and what happened afterwards, closer again to the period of retirement. I think,
well, her point is that he's in this case, in this position, this situation, just months after the injury when he saw Sitow. And Sitow's like, hey, he's looking good. He's, you know, doing well. So her point is within 6 months or whatever down the road, the IMEs and the other doctors are saying, yeah, he's ready to go. So your question is, well, Sitow only saw him on time, but he did seem closer to the incident. So he's getting worse, is your opinion?
It would appear from the medical records, I think, that while maybe there was some initial pain really from the initial acuteness of the injury, and again, none of us are doctors, I suppose, here, but it would certainly seem to, to the reading the medical records that the initial pain may have worn off and that was there some improvement in range of motion and things like that? Yes, in terms of total amount of pain. But that doesn't mean, again, that this is a linear process, that he's getting better. And again, going to the doctors that were treating him, it's clear that if they, I don't know how we could say, well, if they were treating him and they thought he was malingering, like, look, he's just trying to get a pension. Like, he's just trying to do this because he doesn't want to work. And we're talking, Jessica, you were asking questions about, well, what were his post-retirement plans?
ignoring for a second the, okay, well, can he do the job duties versus can he ride it or come a bike or hammer some nails or something, clearly different things. But to say nothing else in the record, nothing that's there objectively of when they were treating him all the way up until, I think it was the first week of July, would indicate they thought he was malingering. He's treating physicians. They were offering kyphoplasty or at least discussing it, injections into his back, things of that nature. So I think that is evidence that it wasn't as though he was like, well, if I buy my military time back, I'll get a, I can just retire out and I'll get this disability pension for a while. At some point, we would say the credibility of those doctors that were treating him would have said, no, we're not going to give you, we're not going to inject something into your back, whether it's cement or a facet block or something else, when we think you're making this up. So I think that, and then given, again, the ultimate issue here, I think, is his inability to do the job as a police officer. And I think where the opinion, the board's opinion falls short is that those two IMEs that found him not disabled really didn't address it. Is it in there? Is it in the questions they were asked? Yes. But Dr. Bergen specifically addressed it. Dr. Glynn did the testing that would more directly address it. That's what shouldn't have been so easily discarded as giving it no weight. So I think that's where it becomes against the manifest weight of the evidence to say this evidence that was more correctly reviewed what the ultimate issue was found to not just be, well, we don't find this persuasive. It's, we're just basically not going to consider it. So given all of that, I would ask that the court find and reverse the board's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any questions, Justice Burkett? Mrs. Smollett. Have a good day, folks. Thanks for your arguments. We'll take this case under advisement and render a decision in due course. Court is in recess until our next oral argument. Safe travels home.